Winston, there with a hand up to his forehead, us no longer hidden from the sun by the house. I'm smiling at just exactly what you want me to, I know it. I finally let go Brenda Kay's hand. This was safe haven here, a place more familiar than the faces of my grandchildren, more comfortable than a down bed in a mansion in Purvis proper. Here we were. I smiled, came toward him. A piece of me was ready to surrender to it all, to this point he was trying so very hard to make by visiting these old places. We had come a long way in our lives, had beaten more than most people were handed out. I moved closer to Leston. This was our home, I was beginning to see, and I was headed straight for what I figured deep down in a place I was about to stop listening to would certainly be our deaths. Leston's, mine, Brenda Kay's. Still, I touched his chest with one hand, smiled up at him, the sunlight in his face. Here was the man I'd sworn allegiance to, the man I'd married, the one who came even before all the before this house brought with it. Before, though it seemed there never existed such a time, even Brenda Kay. This was the man. I am your wife, I heard rise up in me, and I smiled at the man who'd built this home for us. I let my hand go to his face, placed my palm at his cheek, gently rubbed there with my thumb. This touch, just the smallest utterance of the dying language of love our bodies had once spoken. Leston, you know I love you. He reached up, took my hand, and I could feel the strength in him, in his calluses and rough skin and bones and muscles. I love you too, Jewel. He put his hands in his back pockets then, looked past me back toward the barn. Just my husband, after all. This moment of closeness may be a bit too much, or maybe just enough. He shrugged, still grinning. Think I'll have a go look to the shed, see what shape she's in. Brenda Kay, you want to come see the old barn and shed I built? Mama? Brenda Kay was waiting for me, eyebrows up, mouth open, those white teeth. Leston knew what was going on. His own daughter stood next to him but waited for me to nod, to signal what she should do. He reached down, took hold of her hand, gave it a small shake. Come on now, let's go. Brenda Kay's hand was dead in his, her eyes still trained on me. I nodded, smiled. Now you do what your daddy says. She turned, went right away with Leston, and I watched the two of them march off hand in hand along a path clouded over with green. I turned back to the house. Scene of the crime, I thought, and I went to the steps up to the kitchen door, steps I'd mounted too many times to count. After calling my children in from the woods or hauling up the breakfast plates the colored stacked on the ground next to the bottom step, or carrying up the wind-dried sheets and towels and clothing, and I thought of the sheets I'd hung earlier this afternoon, wondered if they'd be dry by the time we got home. I stood at the bottom of the steps, put one hand on the rail, and suddenly all those times I'd mounted them didn't seem such a burden, such a chore. And I saw I was about to hit the bottom of that abyss Leston had led me to, the one I'd tottered over and into all by myself. It was my resolve I was about to lose, I saw. I lifted a foot, set it on the first step up. This was comfortable, the wood strong and sturdy. Exactly what I needed to feel beneath me when I carried up a load of laundry or a child with a skin knee or an apron full of summer squash or corn, and so I took another step and another. Let my hand on the rail guide me up and up, closer and closer to the kitchen door window. Finally, I made it to the top of the steps, stood on the little porch there. I cut my hands to the window, looked in at my own kitchen, and knew it was me. Me I wanted to glimpse, walking across the floor in there, a skillet of bacon and eggs in my hand, my apron for a pot holder, and hoped, too, I'd see Burton and Wilman come tearing into the room, Annie right behind them, trailing Nine-Nine, crying for them to wait for. It was all of that I wanted to see, and I knew I would if I let myself. Let the ghosts of past lives, ones I thought for years were behind me, breathe all over in me, illuminate this old kitchen. And suddenly there was movement inside, a swirl of color and shape before my eyes. I staggered back a step, saw before me a girl in a flowered dress as she swung open the door, a hand to her hip, her head to one side. "What do y'all want?" I saw her dirty blonde hair fall off one shoulder, saw smeared red across her lips, her bare feet. She was just a girl no older than, and I had to think a moment on who she seemed no older than, and the only girl who came to mind was my own baby daughter, my Brenda Kay, tromping around in a broken-down barn just then. We were just looking at the place. "We saw you." But then her face lost its edge, retreated to reveal she was in fact only a girl, no woman in charge of this place. "Somebody in there with you?" She gave the quickest glance to her left, tried to see behind her without looking all the way. Her dress buttoned up the front, starting at the waist, and as she brought up her shoulders, I could see where she'd missed a couple of buttons, the two below the top one. It was a dress a little too tight for her, and I wondered who her mama was and where she might be and who the boy inside the house with her was. Because as she stood taller, in some child's attempt at intimidating an old woman who'd seen all I'd seen about the way this world works, I saw between the open front of her dress the two curves of flesh where her breasts met, small turns of pale milk skin men lived their lives to find. Where only minutes before, I knew, some boy most likely no older than herself had found strange comfort. A feeling I figured must be foreign and familiar at once. Some memory of a mother's breast buried deep inside him. At the same time, a dream of the future. Of the moment when he might enter her and the world would be his. So that memory and the future were locked in the same moment. The same touch of tongue on flesh. The body able to accomplish with no more than mere human touch what it was I wanted in my life. To remember what had gone before me, but to push out to what might be. Only then did I see I hadn't yet fallen into the abyss, but still tottered there, still stood with my toes on the edge, about to fall toward the end of a life that'd be spent here in Mississippi, among the bones of my old dead lives. Ghosts or no ghosts. "You're showing, honey." I nodded at her chest. She looked down at herself, saw the buttons, started doing them up, when from behind her came the boy's voice. "Tell him to head out." She still fumbled with the buttons, glanced at me.
"You heard that?"
I said, "My husband built this house." Then I turned, not because of the boy's words, but because there seemed nothing more to say. I took each step down from the porch, one at a time, savored them for what they were, past history. But when I reached bottom, I turned, looked up at her, and it seemed there was something else I wanted to say, on my own tongue, words I figured might help her and might help me. "Don't let a man speak your mind. You want us out, you tell us." She took a breath, glanced behind her again. She stood straight.
"You head on out now."
I nodded at her, smiled. She closed the door, but stood at the window a moment. I put up a hand, gave a small wave, hoped whatever it was happened here wouldn't be lost on her or on me. Her face was blank, no look to it at all. Then she raised a hand, gave the smallest of waves, just a shake of her fingertips, but enough to make me wonder what my life would have been like if my last child, the daughter named after my husband's dead sister, were born a normal child. And I wondered if that child inside the window might well have been named Brenda Kay, her mama out to work somewheres, Bailey Grandma serving up lunches right now to summer school kids. Her daughter shut up in an empty house right now while a boy had at her, the two of them finding the surprise and sorrow of love. And I felt then, too, some of the burden and joy, perhaps, that Cathedral might have felt by passing on words I could use, given to me fair warning of the life to come while she stood here at the bottom of those steps on a cold March night, me there at the top of them while from behind me spilled warm kitchen light, light that fell out onto the cold, hard-packed ground out here, light that seemed to illuminate Cathedral herself. The girl turned her head from me, nodded to the boy I couldn't see, the boy I was glad I'd never lay eyes on. Then she quick turned back to me, her mouth and eyebrows and eyes filled with nothing, and she disappeared. Leston opened Brenda Kay's door, and she climbed in. I was already in the front seat, windows all down, my forehead and neck and chest and back all drenched in sweat. I hadn't wanted to stand outside the car while I waited for my daughter and husband to come back. I just wanted in the car, wanted gone from there. Leston closed Brenda Kay's door, came round to his side, climbed in. He put the key to the ignition, started up the car, and I looked at him. He seemed scared somehow. His face flushed even more than it would for the heat. He smiled too hard at me, wouldn't let his eyes meet mine for more than an instant. He faced forward, both hands on the wheel, and I wondered if he hadn't been out scouring the woods behind the place looking for a brass lighter. What happened? Nothing. He put a hand to his shirt pocket for another cigarette, came up empty. Maybe the heat, I don't know. I looked out the windshield. Where to next?
Well, figure it's your turn. You tell us where.
I was quiet a moment, the only sound the low hum of the engine. Cathedrals. Take me to Cathedrals. Nelson sat out front in a rocker not much different than the one that had been thrown on a fire in a backyard in Purvis. Leston parked the car in front of the house, and Nelson stopped rocking, slowly stood while Leston climbed out the car. Calling the place a house was giving it more credit than is due. It was a shanty on an ancient road, and suddenly all of it was too much like the shanty I'd stood in front of and had spilled a story to a colored woman while Cleopatra Sinclair and Bessie Swansea stole her food. I got a cold shiver just then, the feeling an ugly surprise in all the heat. Nelson seemed thinner, shorter, and wore thick glasses. His head was down, and slowly he shook it back and forth. One hand was in his back pocket, the other to his forehead, a cigarette between his fingers. He walked forward, stopped in front of the car. He was old, older than I could have imagined, his hair gone white, wrinkles at his throat, the glasses magnifying his eyes so that in the late afternoon light they were huge and wet.
Mr. Hilbum?
Nelson. Leston put out a hand. A moment or two passed between them before Nelson slowly put his own hand out, and the two shook. Three or four nails on Nelson's hand had gone bad white and crumbled and dead. He smiled.
We heard you was here. We was wondering if you'd stop in.
He turned to me, sitting there in the front seat and taking all this in as though it were some performance, staged right off the front of the car just for me. Nelson nodded.
Miss Jewel?
I climbed out then, made careful not to close the door too hard for fear of waking Brenda Kay. I walked to the end of the fender, nodded, though I felt I ought to put out my hand, let him shake it, I didn't. I only smiled, looked at Leston.
We come by to say hello, Nelson. You looking good.
No complaints, just growing old in the Lord. How you doing yourselves?
Fine, Leston said, fine. Just out looking around at the old haunts, old stomping grounds.
He swatted at a mosquito on his arm, smiled. Nelson turned to me, his whole body moving, even his feet as if his back were a board, unable to bend.
You bring along your beautiful daughter, Miss Brenda Kay.
I nodded, smiled at him. Right here. I turned, made for her window. He followed me, and I wondered how old he really was. It seemed at some time I'd known he was 5 or 6 years older than Cathedral, who was a year or so older than me. Maybe 65, 66, I figured. Then wondered what I'd look like, how I'd walk in that not-so-distant future. He leaned over, peered in the window, watched her in silence a few moments. Then he stood straight, smiled at me, his eyes growing even larger with the smile.
Bless her heart.
I was tired of the pleasantries then, tired of the slow movement all this was carrying with it. All of life here in Mississippi carried with it this small dance around the matters at hand rather than talk on the matters. And I smiled back at him, cut my eyes to Leston just behind him, gave a sharp nod he would know. But before Leston could say or do anything, and only enough time for him to blink at my silent demand that he tell Nelson what it was we were really here for, Nelson spoke.
She be in the house. She waiting for you.
I looked at him, saw he'd lost the smile in just that moment. He turned, his feet moving in the slow way they had on his long march from the porch to the car. And now I was behind him, and as he walked in front of me, I thought of how this was the man who'd leaned into the light cast from my kitchen doorway to touch his wife's elbow, to tell her it was time to go on home while she prophesied my life, gave me God's will whether I wanted to hear it or not. This was the man who'd led her on home after that, out into a moonless night, me left outside my kitchen with only the knowledge of what my life would hold.
The baby you be carrying be your hardship, your test in the world.
I walked behind him, moved closer and closer to his porch and toward the woman I still wasn't certain I knew what to say to, what to ask. But she was the woman I knew then I'd been heading toward every day since we'd moved here, and maybe every day since I'd thrown her out of my house, forcing fault on her, blame for the fire that had scarred my baby's legs, scars that, in a twisted blessing all its own, had finally gotten us away from here into California, as much the promised land as any place could ever be. We finally made it to the porch, and I looked up. She stood in the doorway of the shanty, a hand to one door jamb, the other buried in the pocket of the brown plaid dress she had on. I couldn't see a single hair on her head for the blue kerchief she wore, so I couldn't say whether she'd gone gray or white or salt and pepper. She was still tall, still thin, still only and always the same woman, Cathedral. But the piece of sorrow she'd worn in her eyes the morning I'd slapped her, the morning she'd taken that slap and then offered me her other cheek, that sorrow was huge now, exploded in her eyes so that there seemed no touching on what misery she'd known. This seemed the only difference in her eyes. The whites of them brilliant and cold against her black skin, filled with a brilliant and cutting sorrow.
You come here looking for comfort, then you go on home.
Nelson stopped, leaned back and saw his wife.
Don't go to carrying on now. These Mr. Hilburn, Miss Jewel.
Cathedral didn't move, only let her eyes slice into mine. I said, didn't come for comfort.
Then you came for hell.
Her face didn't change, the crisp wrinkles across her forehead and down her cheeks giving away nothing. Nelson made it to the rocker, just touched one arm of it, then turned, slowly lowered himself down to the seat. He didn't start up the rocking again, only sat with both feet firm on the ground, hands on his knees.
We lost a boy a year and 5 months ago. Sepulcher. It been hard on us.
He paused and I felt myself swallow, looked to Cathedral for her reaction to his words. Her eyes were right on mine and I had to break her gaze, look down at something, anything, and I found I was staring at Nelson's knees, at those black pants and how thin the material was, skin straining to break through, it seemed. That was only an old man's knees, an old man's pair of pants.
Cathedral said, "We got no comfort to give."
I looked at her. "I am sorry to hear this." I found I couldn't picture Sepulcher himself, only knew him to be one of the two boys who'd carried me downstairs, loaded me into Leston's pickup for the bumpy ride into town and the hospital, and he'd been the one to fiddle with the cars out to the repair shed. She looked away from me, brought her hand up in front of her, looked at it instead.
Dead in a ditch, eyes open, no accident.
The whole world was silent a moment, and then she looked at me.
You say you don't want no comfort, but I know the truth. You want me to give you the words of Jesus, give some to you like Luke 9:69. And Jesus said unto him, no man, having put his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God.
She stopped, looked to the hand again. Her face still told me nothing, only her words falling down to me here on the ground. This time, her the one up on the porch. I am truly sorry. I swallowed again at the idea of a dead child, a grief I couldn't touch. I heard from behind me Leston's words, Nelson, we're sorry. I felt my husband's hand at my elbow, heard him say, come on now, and tried to remember if those weren't the same exact words Nelson used on his own wife, him coaxing her away from giving the truth to me. I didn't move, and Cathedral went on.
Prophecy ain't worth the widow's mite, nor tongues. No God gift's worth anything but the grace of a child.
She still stared at the hand, looked at the palm. She turned it over, looked at the back as if it might speak.
You want me to give you words to help you make your way in this world, but I ain't here to give them. But I give you words anyhow, not the ones you come for, but words down from God all the same. Words more the truth than any prophecy of your life I ever give. I give unto you words from the 88th Psalm.
Finally, she shot her eyes at me, and I nearly flinched with the weight of them, the heat and the storm there.
The wicked are estranged from the womb. They go astray as soon as they be born, speaking lies. Their poison is like the poison of a serpent. They is like the deaf adder that stoppeth her ear, which will not hearken to the voice of charmers, charming never so wisely.
She paused, made a quick fist of her hand, eyes still on me.
Break their teeth, O God, in their mouth. Break out the great teeth of the young lions, O Lord.
The color of all things went deeper red, the sky above us near scarlet now, the sun touching the trees. I backed away from the porch, backed away until I felt my shoulders touch Leston's chest and stopped. She let the hand drop to her side, made it disappear into her pocket again. She nodded, the sky's color gone to her eyes so that the brilliant, cold white of them was now blood red, the color I figured of a sorrow I hadn't yet touched, the color of a place I'd never been.
If they a prophecy here, it that your life gonna end up this way someday, well, for all of us, we gonna see death and not know what to make of it. Even Jesus say upon the cross, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Even Jesus not know what to make of it.
I felt Leston's arm move round my shoulder, felt him start to pull me back toward the car.
Miss Jewel.
I turned to Cathedral, stopped moving. I looked out of there on the porch, the brown plaid dress soaking up blood from the sky. She smiled.
Don't a day go by, I don't dream on slapping you with this hand of mine.
She held her hand up firm and high in front of her, fingers spread.
Don't a day. Your children, all of them, they alive. I got one dead in a ditch, eyes open. Killed for trying to teach burrhead niggas how to read in a town 100 miles north of here. Don't want no niggas knowing how to read.
She nodded again and I felt my heart lurch, felt it shudder under a sudden and permanent weight, sat there like a stone on my chest.
It you who taught me. That's your legacy. Even your baby daughter. Your hardship and test in this world, she only asleep in a backseat of your shiny car. She only asleep.
I looked down away from her eyes.
I'm sorry.
I knew those two words were too small and insignificant to mean anything. I closed my eyes a moment, then opened them, looked up at her what I was certain would be the final time. But she was already gone, disappeared into the black hole her front doorway'd become in the gathering dark. There was only Nelson, slowly rocking in his chair, hands still on his knees. The creak the chair made the smallest sliver of sound. The coming dark erased all detail to him, though he sat not 15 feet away, and I couldn't see if his eyes were open or closed behind those thick glasses. And with that loss of detail, his black pants had turned clean, brand new, the suspenders down his chest taut and crisp against his fine white shirt.
You take care now.
While I rinsed Brenda Kay in the tub, squeezed cool water over her back and shoulders and face, I heard Leston turn Toxie back, heard low talk out on the porch, then the sound his pickup made starting up, backing out. I took Brenda Kay's hand, helped her out the tub, her eyes closed, me drying off with the towel. Once I'd gotten her to bed, I went to the front room, saw Leston at the screen door staring out at nothing, a beer in one hand, the other in his pocket. I said nothing, only went to the kitchen, then out the back door down the steps to the yard. Tree frogs started up. It was dark now, and I headed for the sheets on the line, knew that if I didn't get them in soon, they'd be drenched in dew by tomorrow morning. Above me, above the bayou and the cypress and oak and pine, above everything, hung a half moon, perched out over the water at the end of the dock like some lost and dying star, trying to find a place to rest. I stopped in the yard, looked to the trees around me. To my left were the clotheslines, the two T-bars at either end. Hanging between them rows of white sheets, a bright gray out here. They hung straight down from the lines, no breeze anywhere, and I went to one end, touched the sheet. It was still damp, hadn't been out long enough to dry in the humid heat of the day. I pulled back that sheet, ducked beneath the line so that I stood between the two rows. Slowly, I moved down them from one end to the other, a hand out to either side, my fingertips trailing along each damp sheet, and for a moment I imagined I was surrounded by gentle ghosts, ghosts who meant nothing, who carried no weight of death or grief or sorrow, ghosts making no demands. I reached the far end and turned, planned to head back down the gray corridor, touch each sheet, send each empty ghost shivering one last time. There at the opposite end stood Leston, him with no detail at all, just a huge and looming shadow. The tip of a cigarette glowed at his side. He lifted it up, and I saw the tip go bright red as he drew on it.
You asked me today if something happened out at the shed.
He paused.
It did.
I let one hand touch the sheet next to me. I caught a corner of it. Fingered it with my thumb and first finger and remembered a moment on a porch when a man with wet and stringy black hair did the same with the corner of a black wool blanket he and three other men had carried my dead father in. What's that? He took in a breath, the cigarette still at his side.
We was back to the shed, looking around, and Brenda Kay near stepped on a copperhead.
What? She what? I started toward him, my hands suddenly at my chest, clutching each other, holding on. As I came near him, I saw his head drop, saw he was looking at the ground.
She didn't step on it, just walked right over it. She didn't even see it. And I wasn't paying attention, I was looking up at the rafters, thinking on how fine she'd held up the shed.
Now my hands let go each other, and one went to him, touched a shoulder.
I hear this shift in the leaves at my feet, and there he was, just slithering right between us. I didn't even grab for it like I'd have done 10 years ago. 10 years ago, I'd have just bent down, picked him up by the tail, and swung him, snapped him.
Finally, he drew in on the cigarette, and I could see in the light from the ember just the barest face, the shine of his eyes, the bones beneath his cheeks.
I was scared.
I touched him with both hands now, and through his shirt I could feel his arms, the bones of them, the thin flesh. I said, I'm scared, too.
Of what?
The cigarette had died down now, and I could only make out the shadow of his eyes, the idea of his mouth. But I knew he was looking at me, and I hoped he might find my answer in whatever of my eyes he could see in this darkness. Scared I was losing my baby daughter to the nothing this place had to give. Scared of Cathedral's words and the death of all of us, I felt this night. Scared my own life was out of my hands. But I said nothing, no words forming in me. I let go his arms, turned to the sheet nearest me, reached up and took off the first clothespin. He didn't move, and out the corner of my eye I could see his own pale fog again, smoke breath easing out his lungs and into the night. Then he was next to me, flicked the cigarette away, took from my hand the sheet corner I held. He ducked beneath the line, moved out into the yard as I took off the next pin, and the next, until I stood with the other end of the sheet, three clothespins in my apron pocket. Without a word, we moved away from the clotheslines, both of us with a sheet corner to a hand. Gently we popped the sheet, shook out any bugs may have been there. Then we came toward each other and our hands touched, the sheet folded in half.
Jewel, don't even put these back up tomorrow. Just go ahead, pack them up.
I nodded, took one end of the folded sheet, took a few steps back. I'll bleach them once we get home, get out any mildew. We came toward each other again and our hands touched again. He said,
I didn't mean it to be this way, sugar.
I stopped with the sheet, stared up at him. We were turned a different way now, the rising moon full in his face, a gray man looking down to his wife, him giving up.
What do you mean?
Though I knew. I knew and knew. He said,
I didn't mean for it to end like this, Shug.
I tried to smile up at him, hoped in the dark he'd think this smile came easy to me, came from down in me and needed no prompting at all.
This isn't the end. Shug, this isn't the end at all.
He looked at me a moment more, then broke his eyes from mine, nodded. This time he took a step back from me and we folded the sheet one last time. He took it from me, held it to his chest, then went for the stairs up to the kitchen. I didn't move for the next sheet, the next clothespin. Instead, I watched him go and thought on his naming of me once again. Sugar. Shug. The last time him calling me that, the night we'd ridden into Purvis, me about to bear Brenda Kay, our lives about to take the giant blind turn it had. And I thought again on Cathedral's words, on blessed words come down from God, words right out of the Bible.
Break their teeth, O God, in their mouth. Break out the great teeth of the young lions, O Lord.
Whether she'd known it or not, Cathedral had broken my teeth. Broken them out in a way better than any slap to the cheek could have done. A son dead in a ditch, I thought. Eyes open because of me and what I'd taught his mother, and I thought of my Brenda Kay asleep in a bed in a bayou palace. A child unable at my own hands to make even the letter R. Leston made it to the steps, but he didn't start up them as I thought he would. No, he placed the folded sheet on the third or fourth step up, then turned. Started back across the lawn, and as my husband came toward me, I wondered how he felt. Now I'd broken all his teeth, broken them once again with a prayer to God, a prayer he'd die enough to see what was best for us. Here was my answered prayer, my husband dead enough now, teeth broken. He was walking easily, hands on his hips as he crossed the lawn. Steps big and comfortable as he made it to the clothesline, started in on the next sheet. I am your wife, I thought. Leston's. Him all movement and peace. 1984. 4:15 and she hadn't got home yet, and what I'm doing is what I do every other time this happens, though it doesn't happen enough for me to feel fine about it, feel a routine to it. Maybe once in 3 months or so she'll be late for one reason or another. Each time I do what I do now, watch the clock on the wall above the sofa, walk to the window every 3 minutes or so and pull back the curtains with a single finger, a finger just like every other of mine, so old, so brown and gnarled I can hardly recognize it as my own. I touch the white material, pull it back an inch or so to see the same empty street we moved to more than 20 years back. This house in Redondo Beach, only a hair larger than the one in Manhattan Beach. But this house has a bigger front yard, a bigger backyard, and behind the row of oleanders at the rear of the yard is a chain-link fence. Behind the fence, a raised platform of dirt. On top of that, train tracks. Trains come through 3 or 4 times a day, and for the first few months we lived here, it'd been a strange thing to wake up in the middle of the night, heavy in my head the dream of Cleopatra Sinclair disappearing into thick green woods, her turning one last time and calling out to me, while around me the room shook, the bed trembling beneath me, the tumbling scrape of wheels on the rails there in the dark. But it wasn't long before all of us, including Brenda Kay, got used to the sound. Not a month after we moved here, too, Leston and Burton had taken out one of those oleanders, cleared a spot for Brenda Kay, who'd taken to making her way to the fence, her with enough courage to stand and wave at the trains passing by, especially at the red caboose, where sometimes a man would lean out, wave back to her. The house was what we'd been able to afford. Wilman and Barbara and Billie Jean lived just down the freeway in Buena Park. Living right over to Torrance was Annie and Jean, and back before they divorced, Burton and Sarah, my middle boy, finding 11 years ago the same ugly territory his older sister discovered so many years before. I look out at the street, the gray asphalt of it, the cracked white cement sidewalk that crosses in front of my house, the green lawn, all of it a place where once my grandchildren, every one of them, grown now, used to ride bikes, used to tussle and fuss and wrestle and laugh. But this afternoon, I don't see the yellow van. Los Angeles County School District printed in black letters across the side of it, pull up to the curb. I don't see any of Brenda Kay's friends. Eyes straight ahead or out the window, none of them, it seems, ever blinking. I don't see Brenda Kay stand from a seat, Barbie lunchbox in hand, pink canvas knapsack in the other. Don't see her slowly make her way out the door and step down to that sidewalk. Her white shoes may be scuffed a little. Nothing, that's what I see. Just that empty out there. Early of a Saturday morning last month, Wilman and Barbara came over, him in his nice new Oldsmobile company car, parking in the driveway right here next to the kitchen windows. I'd been up for an hour or so already, Brenda Kay and me dressed and ready, though it was only 7:30. Brenda Kay was in her recliner, the radio on next to her, and had a ruler and some crayons and a tablet of pastel papers. She was singing and singing, like always, so far from any tune that it didn't matter. Just her voice, her attention on the crayon in her hand, her eyes on the paper. Then I'd heard Wilman's car pull up. "They're here now, let's get a move on," I said. She didn't look up. We were headed to Saugus for the day to visit a Mrs. Tyndall, a woman I'd never met before, but who I'd been told about by the people over to the Gardena Human Services Department. We were headed there for a reason, one I'd been putting off thinking on for the whole of my life and still wasn't ready for. We were headed there because it was a house where retarded girls lived, a house in the valley up there where this Miss Tyndall and her husband cared for girls like my Brenda Kay. For the past 6 or 7 months, Wilman and Burton and James and Ann and Billie Jean had all talked to me about this eventuality, this looking for a place Brenda Kay could live someday. And of course, what this said to me, the real words beneath the ones they kept giving to me, was that my own days left were lined up and waiting, the last of them not too far distant. No news here. This realization lately come into my children's heads, a notion that had been bounding through my own since before I could remember. Since before, certainly, the death of my Leston, him unable to get back on at ECC when we moved back. He'd had to take on a job as a janitor, him dying of a heart attack in a grade school hallway after pushing a mop for 2 years. Or perhaps I'd even known my life was on its way to over, even before Brenda Kay was born, when on an evening in March, James had told us he was signing up for the Army, him the first of my children to leave, that old movement from inside my home out into the world, the first sign in a world filled with signs that my own death was coming up. Nothing more than that. My term of days here on Earth were already winding down even that far back. That was what the trip meant, even though when Wilman came in, I reached up and hugged him and kissed his neck like any other day came to see me, then did the same to Barbara. We were each of us acting like this was just any other Saturday morning visit. Wilman went past me and on into the living room.
Brenda Kay, you fat.
Wilman, you fat too,
Barbara said. We're going to have fun today. We'll go to breakfast at Spire's first and then drive on up there. They're expecting us. Bill, did you remember the pillow for the car? Bill, I thought, and for a moment I wondered who that was, who this woman could be calling out to, and then I remembered. Bill. I heard Brenda Kay laugh. To something Wilman said, I didn't know what. I only heard her laughter. We drove north on the San Diego freeway, me up front with Wilman. Barbara bought a sack full of Tiger Beat and teen magazines and the like. Brenda Kay flipping through them and taking in all the pictures of boys with shirts ripped open to show pale, hairless chests. Traffic was just as slow as any other day, cars and cars round us, more buildings and billboards and reflections off glass and bumpers and all else. More broken light and colors and cars than ever. This city grown too large from that place we'd entered like it was the New Jerusalem in 1952. Then there had been only the one freeway. Deliverance from our past lives. Safe passage into the next. But it had been a dream, all of it. A dream of how I might fix things for us. Brenda Cade never tested higher than a 6-year-old. Not even with the new programs and all the new research and innovations we were always being told about in the newsletters. My arms were crossed against the cool of the air conditioner, that air suddenly too cold, ice in me, and I shivered, turned to my son. I looked at him there with his sunglasses on and saw how the skin beneath his chin had started to sag and saw the trace of blood vessels across his cheeks and how they'd started to break up here and there. I saw the sharp edge of wrinkles beside his mouth, him there in profile to me, and I saw my boy for what he was, a 48-year-old man driving his ancient mother to a place called Saugus and a house where retarded girls lived once their mothers died. He was an orphan, I saw, one of the 5 I'd left here on Earth, and I quick took my eyes from him, looked out the windshield, looked for some deliverance of my own out there. We got there near 11, the sun up high now as we drove along a thin strip of pavement, Miss Tyndall's Road. To the left of us lay a row of brown hills, here and there a lone cottonwood, nothing more. At the base of the hill was a railroad line, empty and straight and heading off into the distance. To the right lay huge fields, flat and not yet plowed up for whatever it was they grew here. My hands had gone all sweaty, starting to shaking a bit, too, with how close we were coming to this end, my end. My hands shook, and then I could feel the sweat on my back, even though I was sitting in this plush beige velour seat, seats almost the same color as those hills out there, seats more soft, more comfortable than any piece of furniture I'd ever had in my house.
There it is.
Barbara's arm shot out in the front seat like she was some little girl herself. Finally got to some place she'd ridden weeks to get to. It was only a house, 2 stories with pale blue clapboard, no shutters, a chimney running up the near side. The house was on our right, 100 yards or so set off from the road and out in the fields. Then we eased onto that drive, and suddenly the house seemed huge, and I couldn't move. Wilman popped open his door, as did Barbara, but before either got out, they stopped, and I could tell they were watching me watch this house. I turned in my seat, made my eyes go straight to Brenda Kay. I wanted to see her reaction to this place, this house that could end up her home. I wanted to see on her face whatever it was this place registered in her, some face that might betray she knew what was going on here. I was looking for some fear in her, maybe some kind of dread in how her eyes took it in and how she held her mouth. But she was only looking at the magazine in her hand, her eyes going back and forth across it as though she might be able to read the small amount of words beneath the pictures there. I felt tears well up in me, the hard knot at my throat like a cold fist, because this was the truth of me. I wanted to find in my child fear of the future, when all along I saw it was me who was afraid. Brenda Kay more equipped than any of us for my ending, because she could not know what loss was. She'd sometimes call out to me in the kitchen of an evening, "Miss Daddy!" I'd go into the living room, a dish towel in my hands as I dried them off, and I'd search her face for some sign of tears, of genuine grief, only to see her smile, point at a tall man in a Marlboro ad in a magazine. I held out my hand to her. "Let's go on in." I felt Wilman's hand on my shoulder, felt him give a gentle squeeze there. Still, I searched for something in Brenda Kay, some evidence I knew and did not want to know of me. Of me. I found nothing. Finally, she only looked up, smiled at me, her heavy, wide face near as wrinkled, near as old and sagging and aged as my baby son's next to me. She was 41 years old now. A baby the doctor said would never live past 2, would never walk. Here smiling at me. And there were her eyes, her almond-shaped eyes beneath auburn eyebrows, her auburn hair cut short as always, bangs across her forehead like she was 10. But it was her eyes I saw, and that green, Leston's eyes. I tried to smile, her image trembling for the tears I held in my eyes. Tears I didn't want to let fall, not now. Those were Leston's eyes she had, and I could not cry at that. Miss Tyndall opened the front door even before I could knock. She was a woman of Barbara's age, but thinner. Her brown hair pulled back in a ponytail at the base of her neck, wrinkles beside her eyes, smaller ones beside her mouth. Her skin was dark and tan and clean.
"Welcome. Welcome, Mrs. Hilburn. I'm Nancy Tyndall."
I took her hand. She shook mine hard and strong and firm, and already I liked her just for that, and for the reason she seemed happy, smiled without putting too much in it. She seemed real, and when she let go my hand, she went right to Brenda Kay, held out a hand for her to take.
"You have to be Brenda Kay, Hilburn."
Brenda Kay took her hand, though she hadn't yet committed to smiling, only shot her eyes from me to this woman and back again.
"We've got lunch coming up soon as we can round up the girls. You guys just follow me. And pardon whatever mess you find in here, too."
And we followed her.
The girls, Jenny, Adelaide, Margaret, Joe, Rachel, Patty, Karen, Sammy, Wendy, Olivia, Martha. 11 of them, with room for 12. Janine, number 12, had died a month ago, Miss Tyndall told me over the phone when I'd called her the first time to set all this up. She'd lingered a moment over the girl's name, letting the word Janine hang there on the line for a moment or two before she'd hooked to it the words, "died last month." And I wasn't certain if she was putting the words together that slowly for herself and what grief she had in her, or if it were for me, some sort of revealing of the obvious. Our children die.
every one of them, whether we are here or not. We ate lunch in the kitchen. Her husband, Larry, a small man with quiet eyes and big hands, in the dining room supervising the girls. We leaned against the countertops in the kitchen, a room filled with light from the row of big windows that looked onto the back of the place. After we were done with lunch, Nancy headed over to the sink, calling out over her shoulder, "Line up!" She held a wash rag under running water there in the sink, and suddenly here came the girls. The girls did exactly as Nancy Tindall asked. They lined up, the first one at the sink, the line going out the kitchen door and disappearing into the dining room. Nancy wrung out the rag, handed it to the first girl, a girl a little shorter than Brenda Kay and with black hair that fell to her shoulders. She took the rag, wiped her hands with it, handed it back to Nancy. "Thank you for lunch, Nancy." Her eyes were right on Nancy's, and Nancy leaned over, gave her a hug, the first girl's arms reaching round Nancy's shoulders. Her hands patted Nancy's back a couple of times, and then the two let go. Nancy said, "You're welcome, Rachel." Nancy did each girl this way, and we watched it all. In a way, it was funny to watch all this going on in the kitchen. 11 retarded girls, all about the same age as Brenda Kay, give or take 5 years or so, parading through, most of them short and round, some, like Olivia, a little taller, thinner, but each of them looked happy in her own way. They were just girls, each of them different, each of them dressed in clean clothes, whether sweatshirts and sweatpants or in shorts and blouses and tennis shoes. They were all happy, it seemed, and I knew one couldn't ask for anything more than that. Nothing more. Then came the last girl from the dining room, my Brenda Kay, who stood behind a girl that could have been a sister. A girl, it turned out, was named Sammy. She smiled and smiled at Nancy. She held Nancy the longest of any girl so far. "I love you, Nancy." "I love you too, Sammy." Now Nancy held the rag out to Brenda Kay, who stood with her hands at her sides. She was looking at Nancy's eyes, her mouth open the way she does when she's not certain what to do. I cleared my throat. "She doesn't know," but Nancy put up a hand to me, held it out like a traffic cop ordering me to stop. Brenda Kay's eyes were still on Nancy's. Her hands were still at her sides. "Thankful lunch." Nancy nodded. "You're welcome, Brenda Kay." She reached to one of Brenda Kay's hands, took it in hers, gently wiped it with the warm wash rag. I stood there and felt myself growing smaller, shrinking away from the world and everything I'd ever tried to do in it. She held my daughter's hand and wiped it, turned it in her own and wiped it again. Then she let go that hand, took Brenda Kay's other hand in hers, and I felt myself disappearing into the air around me. A feeling I'd known would someday come, but which, now it was here, wasn't welcome at all. Yet here we were, and I watched as Nancy put the rag in the sink and bent down, put her arms around my daughter, my Brenda Kay, the child born out of 22 hours of labor and countless hours of pain. And suddenly the pain I'd known and given her to this earth was a simple pinprick, a splinter in my finger compared to this feeling now, and how my daughter seemed to be swallowed up in the arms of this woman. Nancy's arms were around my daughter, and I felt I'd already lost her. Felt I might as well have been dead and gone already for those loving arms around my Brenda Kay. But then I saw Brenda Kay's eyes look to me, those deep water green eyes of Leston's. Her eyes were on mine, asking, I could see in them, still looking for me and what she ought to do. And with those eyes on me, I finally knew the truth of why we were here. It wasn't the end of my life we were preparing for, but the beginning of the next life for Brenda Kay. My lives, the long string of them that started with the death of my daddy and went on from there, right up to and including this moment. That long string of lives wasn't over. My life would never be over, but would be carried on, I saw, in Wilman here at my side and in James in Texas, and Burton in his big house in Palos Verdes, and in Billie Jean in her mobile home in Buena Park, and in Annie in her house in Torrance, and in all the hordes of grandchildren and great-grandchildren to follow after me. My life would never end, I saw, not even in my own Brenda Kay, because of those eyes turned to me and asking what to do. The only true victory any mother could ever hope for, the looking of a child, whether retarded or not, to you, for what wisdom you could give away before you left for whatever reckoning you had with the God who'd given you that wisdom in the first place. And so, because it seemed the only valuable thing I could give her, the sum total of my life wrapped up into this moment, I gave to her all I knew, my eyes on her own, meeting for what felt the last time. I nodded for her to go right ahead, for her to hold on to Miss Tyndall. I nodded. Her eyes hung on mine a moment more, then she closed them, and as if in proof to me she learned everything there in that moment, she slowly brought her arms up and placed them on this Nancy Tyndall's shoulders, and she held her, patted Nancy's back once, twice, three times. I closed my eyes. There's still nothing out my window. Still nothing, though the sun is fast on its way down out there. Just beneath it and beyond the tops of houses, the thick bank of gray fog just off the coast, ready to roll in and swallow us all. And so it is settled. Whenever I won't, Brenda Kay has a home in Saugus. I don't need any more visits, any more homes for retarded girls, though I'm certain there's folly in this, and having no other place in mind for. But what I took from that place is worth everything to me. But none of that matters, because she's not here now, and I picture again for the thousandth time a yellow van rolled on Sepulveda or some such street where cars drive too fast and where it is easy to get killed any day of the week, any hour of a day here in California. I let the curtain fall from my fingers again, resolved now to call the school, though each time she's late they say the same thing. You know traffic, and don't worry, she'll be home soon. But I call anyway. Someone answers on the sixth ring, and my words spill out of me, a tangled chain of them that betray how old I am, how afraid I can be at the simple fact of a late van from the school. And once those words have left me, the woman at the other end says, Torrance Redondo Beach Run, and I nod and nod, and finally say, yes, yes. New driver, she says, you're not the only one to call. It's his first day, she says, then pauses, says, and you know traffic, okay? Her last words tacked on as if I'm to take this reason and wrap myself in the comfort of it. Feel somehow safer, both for me and for my child. It's almost 5 now. I stand at the kitchen window waiting for the train to come, for the tremendous heave and rumble that used to wake my grandchildren when they spent nights, and that used to wake me too, my first months here. Leston warm in bed next to me, Brenda Kay settled in her own room and asleep. Those first nights I would sit up in bed and listen to the huge and shambling sound the train made passing by. A black animal high on the dirt platform above the bushes at the back of the yard. How big that sound seemed then. How important and lonely and dangerous there in the middle of the night. Those first days when all my children were grown and gone, married, making children of their own. I wondered all these things. Me standing at the window and here finally, after what I only then realize is perhaps the second or third time, a horn honking in front of my house, the sound of it nearly lost to me wallowing here in my kitchen. I make it to the door and down the steps. Brenda Kay is already stepping off the van and moving fast up the driveway. She just brushes past me, her mouth closed tight, her eyes to the ground as she moves quickly. Her arms swinging away, in one hand the lunchbox, the other her pink knapsack. For a moment I turn to her, watch her moving away from me, and I can see there, above the garage, the train moving fast past us all, and I see how dark that eastern sky really is, and how late in my life all of this is coming. All of it. Brenda Kay is headed to the backyard, where she will stand with her face pressed to the small space of chain-link fence Burton still keeps cleared for. She'll stand there, do as she has for more than 20 years now, peer up at the train passing by, and wave. Soon Brenda Kay's back at the kitchen table, back from waving at the train. She starts pulling out today's papers from a knapsack, the lunchbox already left in the sink. Though I need to start dinner, need to get us ready for the night ahead of us, need to start thinking about running water for the bath, about laying out of clothes for tomorrow, and about what she'll bring for lunch tomorrow, too. Though there is all of this to think about, the only thing I can see myself doing right then is sitting down at the table with her and looking at her, taking her in. Not long from this moment, she will be up from the table and in the living room, the television popped on to reruns of shows she's seen 100 times already, but which she'll laugh at all the same. She'll sit there in the recliner and slather her hands with hand lotion and then wipe them on the towels I've draped on the armrests for just that purpose. Not long from this moment, I'll be cooking up the box of macaroni and cheese, slicing up bits of ham to toss in it, boiling up snap beans. Not long from this moment, we will none of us be here. She pulls from the knapsack a purple sheet of paper, a flyer from school. She holds it up, says, "Dance, Mama," and hands it to me, her face in its smile, her eyes alive with the prospect of going to one of these events. I take the paper, read it. Snoopy is on it, there in his ranger hat and grinning. He holds a placard on it typed, "Dance, for those with developmental disabilities, their friends and family. Friday, April 14th, Gardena Community Center, 7 o'clock to 9:30 p.m. I look at her, expecting her to be watching me, but she is only digging in a knapsack for something else, her mind on the next thing she has to show me. She pulls it out, smiling again, shouts, "Bingo!" and hands me the next sheet. This one is yellow, the words on it set off in a square border decorated with butterflies and flowers. Family bingo for persons with developmental disabilities, their friends and family members. I quick read through it, see that this event, like all the others, is at the center, the Friday 2 weeks from now. At the bottom of the sheet, in big balloony letters and with a smiling sun coming up behind it, are the words, "Have a happy day." And again, I turn to Brenda Kay, expecting to see her watching my face for whatever might come across it, evidence of whether or not we'll go to either of these events. But she is still digging in a knapsack, and I say, "How much more, Brenda Kay?" and tilt my head to one side, ready and waiting to be annoyed at how the girls down to the center organized too much for these children. Too many events and lives already jammed and overflowing with the simple and giant tasks of making it through a day. Then she pulls out the next sheet. "Look, Mama," she shouts, and it seems her voice is louder than it has ever been, louder than my wailing in the delivery room, louder than the cries of my children at their father's funeral, or the sounds of tree frogs on a night in Mississippi, louder than anything I have ever heard, her small words filling the world. "Look, Mama!" She holds up only a sheet of paper, a thin sheet of lined newsprint paper torn from a tablet not much different than I'd had when I was a girl, when the world was ready and willing to be filled with all I could teach it. She holds up a sheet of paper torn from a tablet like those she's had all her own life, too. Tablets she's been filling for more than 30 years now. She holds up a single sheet torn from a tablet like the one I taught Cathedral to write on, a woman who'd pretended all this, who told me the truth all the way back then on an evening in Mississippi, the first day I'd known Brenda Kay was in me. "This baby I've carried my entire life is my hardship in this world, my test, and the way God has smiled down on me, too." She holds the sheet up for me to read, holds it in front of my face, a hand on either edge, those short fingers of hers gripping tight the paper, what is written on it, everything that could ever matter to her here in this world. Only letters, rows of them. The first letter of her name. She's written thousands of these before, filled tablet and tablet and tablet, but on this night, they are enough. More than enough. The sky now black outside the kitchen window. The train tracks gone quiet until sometime late tonight, when the house will shudder once again, and God might wake me from my sleep, bring me to the bedroom window to see the train moving outside. That black shadow moving forward on into the night and leading me away from here. From Brenda Kay, alone and asleep in the next room. From the rest of my children. From the ghosts of the lives I've been blessed enough and cursed enough to have led. Only letters, labored, indifferent, yet full as she can make them of herself. Letters I finally hear singing with all they have. Scores of them swirling round me in voices I'll never understand, but beautiful all the same. God smiling and smiling and smiling.
Jewel was written by Brett Lott and read by Celia Weston. It was abridged for audio by Jan Werner. The recording engineer was Paul Fowley. Editing and post-production by Stephen Strassman. The mix engineer was Rick Brantley. The associate producer was Florence Barreau Adams. Jewel was produced and directed by Elisa Shokoff. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.